the absolute inadequacy of every single institution in the civilization of magical Britain is what happened. You cannot comprehend it, boy. I cannot comprehend it. It has to be seen, and even then it cannot be believed. You will have observed, perhaps, that of your fellow students who speak of their families' occupations, 3 in 4 seem to mention jobs in some part or other of the ministry. You will wonder how a country can manage to employ 3 of its 4 citizens in bureaucracy. The answer is that if they did not all prevent each other from doing their jobs, none of them would have any work left to do. The Aurors were competent as individual fighters. They did fight dark wizards, and only the best survived to train new recruits. But their leadership was in absolute disarray. The ministry was so busy routing papers that the country had no effective opposition to Voldemort's attacks except myself, Dumbledore, and a handful of untrained irregulars. A shiftless, incompetent, cowardly layabout, Mundungus Fletcher, was considered a key asset in the Order of the Phoenix, because being otherwise unemployed, he did not need to juggle another job. I tried weakening Voldemort's attacks to see if it was possible for him to lose. At once, the ministry committed fewer Aurors to oppose me. I had read Mao's little red book. I had trained my Death Eaters in guerrilla tactics. For nothing. For nothing. I was attacking all of magical Britain, and in every engagement my forces outnumbered their opposition. In desperation, I ordered my Death Eaters to systematically assassinate every single incompetent managing the Department of Magical Law Enforcement. One paper pusher after another volunteered to accept higher positions despite the fate of their predecessors, gleefully rubbing their hands at the prospect of promotion. Every one of them thought they would cut a deal with Lord Voldemort on the side. It took 7 months to murder our way through them all. And not a single Death Eater asked why we were bothering. And then, even with Bartimus Crouch risen to director and Amelia Bones as head Aura, it was still too little. I could have done better fighting alone. Dumbledore's aid was not worth his moral restraints, and Crouch's aid was not worth his respect for the law.
And eventually,
Harry said through the heart sickness,
you realized you were just having more fun as Voldemort.
It is the least annoying role I have ever played, If Lord Voldemort says that something is to be done, people, obey him, and do not argue. I did not have to suppress my impulse to cruciate people being idiots. For once, it was all part of the role. If someone was making the game less pleasant for me, I just said, Avada Kedavra, regardless of whether that was strategically wise, and they never bothered me again.
Professor Quirrell casually chopped a small worm into bits.
But my true epiphany came on a certain day when David Monroe was trying to get an entry permit for an Asian instructor in combat tactics, and a ministry clerk denied it, smiling smugly. I asked the ministry clerk if he understood that this measure was meant to save his life, and the ministry clerk only smiled more. Then, in fury, I threw aside masks and caution. I used my legitimacy. I dipped my fingers into the cesspit of his stupidity and tore out the truth from his mind. I did not understand, and I wanted to understand. With my command of legitimacy, I forced his tiny clerk brain to live out alternatives, seeing what his clerk brain would think of Lucius Malfoy, or Lord Voldemort, or Dumbledore standing in my place.
Professor Quirrell's hands had slowed as he delicately peeled bits and small strips from a chunk of candle wax.
What I finally realized that day is complicated, boy, which is why I did not understand it earlier in life. To you, I shall try to describe it anyway. Today, I know that Dumbledore does not stand at the top of the world, for all that he is the supreme mugwump of the International Confederation. People speak ill of Dumbledore openly. They criticize him proudly and to his face, in a way they would not dare stand up to Lucius Malfoy. You have acted disrespectfully toward Dumbledore, boy. Do you know why you did so?
I'm not sure, Harry said.
Having Tom Riddle's leftover neural patterns was certainly an obvious hypothesis.
Wolves, dogs, even chickens fight for dominance among themselves. What I finally understood from that clerk's mind was that to him, Lucius Malfoy had dominance. Lord Voldemort had dominance, and David Monroe and Albus Dumbledore did not. By taking the side of good, by professing to abide in the light, we had made ourselves unthreatening. In Britain, Lucius Malfoy has dominance, for he can call in your loans, or send ministry bureaucrats against your shop, or crucify you in the Daily Prophet if you go openly against his will. And the most powerful wizard in the world has no dominance, because everyone knows that he is
Professor Quirrell's lips curled.
A hero out of stories, relentlessly self-effacing, and too humble for vengeance. Tell me, child, have you ever seen a drama where the hero, before he consents to save his country, demands so much gold as a barrister might receive for a court case?
Actually, there have been a lot of heroes like that in Muggle fiction. I'll name Han Solo, just to start.
Well, in magical drama, it is not so. It is all humble heroes like Dumbledore. It is the fantasy of the powerful slave who will never truly rise above you, never demand your respect, never even ask you for pay. Do you understand now?
I think so, Harry said.
Frodo and Samwise from Lord of the Rings did seem to match the archetype of a completely non-threatening hero.
You're saying that's how people think of Dumbledore? I don't believe the Hogwarts students see him as a hobbit.
In Hogwarts, Dumbledore does punish certain transgressions against his will, so he is feared to some degree, though the students still make free to mock him in more than whispers. Outside this castle, Dumbledore is sneered at. They began to call him mad, and he aped the part of a fool. Step into the role of a savior out of place, and people see you as a slave to whose services they are entitled, and whom it is their enjoyment to criticize. For it is the privilege of masters to sit back and call forth helpful corrections while the slaves labor. Only in the tales of the ancient Greeks, from when men were less sophisticated in their delusions, may you see the hero who is also high. Hector, Aeneas, those were heroes who retained their right of vengeance upon those who insulted them, who could demand gold and jewels in payment for their services without sparking indignation. And if Lord Voldemort conquered Britain, he might then condescend to show himself noble in victory, and nobody would take his goodwill for granted, nor chirp corrections at him if his work was not to their liking. When he won, he would have true respect. I understood that day in the Ministry that by envying Dumbledore, I had shown myself as deluded as Dumbledore himself. I understood that I had been trying for the wrong place all along. You should know this to be true, boy, for you have made freer to speak ill of Dumbledore than you ever dared speak ill of me. Even in your own thoughts, I wager, for instinct runs deep. You knew that it might be to your cost to mock the strong and vengeful Professor Quirrell, but that there was no cost in disrespecting the weak and harmless Dumbledore.
Thank you,
Harry said through the pain.
For that valuable lesson, Professor Quirrell. I see that you are right about what my mind was doing.
though Tom Riddle's memories had probably also had something to do with the way he had sometimes lashed out at Dumbledore for no good reason, Harry hadn't been like that around Professor McGonagall, who, admittedly, had the power to deduct house points and didn't have Dumbledore's air of tolerance. No, it was still true. Harry would have been more respectful, even in his own thoughts, if Dumbledore had not seemed safe to disrespect. So, that had been David Munro, and that had been Lord Voldemort. It still hadn't answered the most puzzling question, and Harry wasn't sure that asking it would be wise. If somehow Lord Voldemort had managed not to think of it, and then Professor Quirrell had still managed not to think of it during 9 years of contemplation, then it wasn't wise to say. Or maybe it was. The agonies of the Wizarding War had not been good for Britain. Harry decided, and spoke.
One thing that did confuse me was why the Wizarding War lasted so long, Harry ventured. I mean, maybe I'm underestimating the difficulties that were facing Lord Voldemort.
You want to know why I did not imperious some of the stronger wizards who could imperious others, slay the very strongest wizards who could have resisted my imperious, and taken over the ministry in, perhaps 3 days?
Harry nodded silently. Professor Quirrell looked contemplative. His hands were sifting grass clippings into the cauldron, bit by bit. That ingredient, if Harry remembered correctly, was something like 4/5 towards the end of the recipe.
"I wondered that myself," the defense professor said finally. "When I heard Trelawney's prophecy from Snape, and I contemplated the past as well as the future, if you had asked my past self why he did not use the Imperius, he would have spoken of the need to be seen to rule, to openly command the ministry bureaucracy, before it was time to turn his eyes outward to other countries. He would have remarked on how a quick and silent victory might bring challenges later. He would have remarked on the obstacle presented by Dumbledore and his incredible defensive prowess. And he would have similar excuses for every other quick path he considered. Somehow, it was never the right time to bring my plans to their final phase. There was always one more thing to do first. Then I heard the prophecy, and I knew that it was time, for time itself was taking notice of me. That the span for hesitation was done. And I looked back and realized somehow this had been going on for years. I think..."
The occasional bit of grass was dropping down from his hand, but Professor Quirrell did not seem to pay it any mind.
"I thought, when I was contemplating my past beneath the starlight, that I had become too accustomed to playing against Dumbledore. Dumbledore was intelligent. He tried diligently to be cunning. He did not wait for me to strike, but presented me with surprises. He made bizarre moves that played out in fascinating and unpredictable ways. In retrospect, there were many obvious plans for destroying Dumbledore. But I think some part of me did not want to go back to playing solitaire instead of chess. It was when I had the prospect of creating another Tom Riddle to plot against, someone even more worthy than Dumbledore, that I was first willing to contemplate the end of my war. Yes, in retrospect, that sounds stupid, but sometimes our emotions are more foolish than we can bring our reason to admit. I would never have espoused such a policy deliberately. It would have violated Rules 9, 16, 20, and 22, and that is too much if you are enjoying yourself. But to repeatedly decide that there is one more thing left to be done, one more advantage left to be gained, one more piece that I simply had to move into place before abandoning an enjoyable time in my life and move on to the more tedious rulership of Britain. Well, even I am not immune to a mistake like that, if I do not realize that I am making it.
And that was when Harry knew what was going to happen at the end of this, after the Philosopher's Stone had been retrieved. At the end of this, Professor Quirrell was going to kill him. Professor Quirrell didn't want to kill him. It was possible that Harry was the only person in the world against whom Professor Quirrell wouldn't be able to use a killing curse. But Professor Quirrell thought he had to do it, for whatever reason. That was why Professor Quirrell had decided that it was necessary to brew the potion of effulgence the long way. That was why Professor Quirrell had been so easily negotiated into answering these questions, into finally talking about his life with someone who might understand. Just like Lord Voldemort had delayed the end of the Wizarding War to play longer against Dumbledore. Harry couldn't exactly recall what Professor Quirrell had said earlier about not killing Harry. It hadn't been anything straightforward along the lines of, "I am absolutely not planning to kill you in any way, shape, or form unless you positively insist on doing something stupid." Harry had been reluctant himself to push the promise too far and insist on unambiguous terms because Harry had already known that he would need to neutralize Lord Voldemort and had expected more precise language to reveal that fact, if they tried to exchange truly binding promises. So, there certainly would have been loopholes, whatever had been said. There was no particular shock to the realization, just an increased sense of urgency. Some part of Harry had already known this and had simply been waiting for an excuse to make it known to deliberation. There had been too many things said here that Professor Quirrell would not reveal to anyone with an expected lifespan measured in more than hours. The overwhelming isolation and loneliness of the life Professor Quirrell had described might explain why he was willing to violate his rules and talk with Harry, given that Harry was going to die soon, and that the world did not actually work like a play where the villain disclosing his plans would always fail to kill the hero afterward. But Harry's death certainly had to be in those future plans somewhere. Harry swallowed, controlling his breath. Professor Quirrell had just added a tuft of horsehair to the potion of effulgence, and that was very late in the potion, if Harry remembered correctly. There weren't many bellflowers left in the heap to be added, either. It was probably time to stop worrying so much about risk and play this conversation less conservatively, all things considered.
If I point out one of Lord Voldemort's mistakes, Harry said, does he punish me for it?
Professor Quirrell lifted his eyebrows.
Not if the mistake is a real one. I do not suggest that you moralize at me, but I will not curse the bearer of bad news, nor the subordinate who makes an honest attempt to point out a problem. Even as Lord Voldemort, I could never bring myself to that stupidity. Of course, there were some fools who mistook my policy for weakness, who tried to thrust themselves forward by pushing me down in their public council, thinking me obliged to tolerate it as criticism.
Professor Quirrell smiled reminiscently.
The Death Eaters were better off without them, and I do not advise you make the same mistake.
Harry nodded, a slight shiver going through him.
When you told me about what happened in Godric's Hollow, on Halloween night, in 1981, I mean, I thought I saw another flaw in your reasoning, a way you could have avoided disaster, but, I think you have a blind spot, a class of strategies you don't consider. So you didn't see it, even afterward.
I hope you are not about to say something stupid along the lines of, don't try to kill people,
Professor Quirrell said.
I shall be very unhappy if that is the case.
Not values difference. True mistake given your goals. Will you hurt me if I act the part of the teacher toward you and teach lesson? Or if mistake is simple and obvious and makes you feel stupid?
No,
hissed Professor Quirrell.
Not if lesson is true.
Harry swallowed.
Why didn't you test the Horcrux system before you actually had to use it?
Test it?
Said Professor Quirrell. He looked up from the brewing potion, and indignation came into his voice.
What do you mean, test it?
Why didn't you test if the Horcrux system was working correctly before you needed it on Halloween?
Professor Quirrell looked disgusted.
You ridiculous... I didn't want to die, Mr. Potter, and that was the only way to test my great creation. What good would it have done to risk my life sooner rather than later? How would I have been better off?
Harry swallowed a lump in his throat.
There was way for you to test your Horcrux system without dying. The general lesson is important. Do you see it now?
No,
Professor Quirrell said after a while. The defense professor gently crumbled one of the last bellflowers together with a strand of long blonde hair, and then dropped it into the potion, which was bubbling brighter now. Only two more bellflowers remained on the potions table.
And I do hope your lesson is a sensible one. For your sake.
Suppose, Professor, that I learned how to cast the improved Horcrux spell, and I was willing to use it. What would I do with it?
Professor Quirrell answered at once.
You would find some person whom you found morally abhorrent, and whose death you could convince yourself would save other lives, and murder them to create a Horcrux.
And then what?
Make more Horcruxes,
said the defense professor. He picked up a jar of what looked like dragon scales.
Before that,
Harry said. After a time, the defense professor shook his head.
I still do not see it, and you will cease this game and tell me.
I would make Horcruxes for my friends. If you'd ever really cared about one single other person in the entire world, if there'd been just one person who gave your immortality meaning, someone that you wanted to live forever with you.
Harry's throat choked.
Then the idea of making a Horcrux for someone else wouldn't have been such a counterintuitive thought.
Harry was blinking hard.
You have a blind spot around strategies that involve doing nice things for other people, to the point where it stops you from achieving your selfish values. You think it's not your style, I suppose. That particular part of your self-image is what cost you those 9 years.
The dropper of mint oil that the defense professor was holding added liquid to the cauldron, drip by drip.
I see,
the defense professor said slowly.
I see. I should have taught Rabistan the advanced Horcrux ritual and forced him to test the invention. Yes, that is supremely obvious in retrospect. For that matter, I could have ordered Rabistan to try marking himself onto some disposable infant to see what happened before I took myself to Godric's Hollow to create you.
Professor Quirrell shook his head bemusedly.
Well, I am glad I'm realizing this now, and not 10 years earlier. I had enough to chide myself for at that time.
You don't see nice ways to do the things you want to do,
Harry said. His ears heard a note of desperation in his own voice.
Even when a nice strategy would be more effective, you don't see it because you have a self-image of not being nice.
That is a fair observation, said Professor Quirrell. Indeed, now that you have pointed it out, I have just now thought of some nice things I can do this very day to further my agenda.
Harry just looked at him. Professor Quirrell was smiling.
Your lesson is a good one, Mr. Potter. From now on, until I learn the trick of it, I shall keep diligent watch for cunning strategies that involve doing kindness for other people. Go and practice acts of goodwill, perhaps, until my mind goes there easily.
Cold chills ran down Harry's spine. Professor Quirrell had said this without the slightest visible hesitation. Lord Voldemort was almost certain that he could never be redeemed. He wasn't the tiniest bit afraid of it happening to him. The second-to-last bellflower was dropped into the potion gently.
"Any other valuable lessons you would like to teach to Lord Voldemort, boy?"
said Professor Quirrell. He was looking up from the potion and grinning as though he knew exactly what Harry was thinking.
"Yes,"
Harry said, his voice almost breaking.
"If your goal is to obtain happiness, then doing nice things for other people feels better than doing them for yourself."
"Do you really think I never thought of that, boy?"
The smile had vanished.
"Do you think I am stupid? After graduating Hogwarts, I wandered the world for years before I returned to Britain as Lord Voldemort. I have put on more faces than I bothered counting. Do you think I never tried to play the hero just to see how it would feel? Have you come across the name of Alexander Chernyshov? Under that guise, I sought out a forlorn hellhole ruled over by a dark wizard, and I freed the wretched inhabitants from their bondage. They wept tears of gratitude for me. It did not feel like anything in particular. I even stayed about and killed the next 5 dark wizards to try taking command of the place. I spent my own galleons, well, not my own galleons, but the same principle applies, to prettify their little country and introduce a semblance of order. They grovelled all the more, and named 1 in 3 of their infants Alexander. I still felt nothing, so I nodded to myself, wrote it off as a fair try, and went upon my way.
And were you happy as Lord Voldemort, then?
Harry's voice had risen, grown wild. Professor Quirrell hesitated, then shrugged.
It appears you already know the answer to that.
Then why? Why be Voldemort if it doesn't even make you happy?
Harry's voice broke.
I'm you. I'm based on you, so I know that Professor Quirrell isn't just a mask. I know he's somebody you really could have been. Why not just stay that way? Take your curse off the defense position and just stay here. Use the Philosopher's Stone to take David Munro's shape and let the real Quirinus Quirrell go free. If you say you'll stop killing people, I'll swear not to tell anyone who you really are. Just be Professor Quirrell for always. Your students would appreciate you. My father's students appreciate him.
Professor Quirrell was chuckling over the cauldron as he stirred it.
There are perhaps 15,000 wizards living in magical Britain, child. There used to be more. There is a reason they're afraid to speak my name. You would forgive me that because you liked my battle magic lessons?
Seconded,
said Harry's inner Hufflepuff.
Seriously, what the hell?
Harry kept his head raised, though it was trembling.
It's not my place to forgive anything you've done, but it's better than another war.
Ha!
Said the defense professor.
If you ever find a time-turner that goes back 40 years and can alter history, be sure to tell Dumbledore that before he rejects Tom Riddle's application for the defense position. But, alas, I fear that Professor Riddle would not have found lasting happiness in Hogwarts.
Why not?
Because I still would have been surrounded by idiots, and I wouldn't have been able to kill them,
Professor Quirrell said mildly.
Killing idiots is my great joy in life, and I'll thank you not to speak ill of it until you've tried it for yourself.
There's something that would make you happier than that, Harry said, his voice breaking again. There has to be.
Why? Said Professor Quirrell. Is this some scientific law I have not yet encountered? Tell me of it.
Harry opened his mouth, but couldn't find any words.
There had to be something.
Had to be something. If he could just find the right thing to say.
And you, said Professor Quirrell, have no right to speak of happiness either. Happiness is not what you hold precious above all. You decided that in the beginning, all the way back in the beginning of this year, when the Sorting Hat offered you Hufflepuff. Which I know about, because I received a similar offer and warning all those years ago, and I refused it just as you did. Beyond this, there is little more to say between Tom Riddles.
The defense professor turned back to the cauldron. Before Harry could think of any way to reply, Professor Quirrell dropped in the last bellflower, and a burst of glowing bubbles boiled up from the cauldron.
"I believe we are done here," Professor Quirrell said. "If you have further questions, they must wait."
Harry shakily rose to his feet, even as Professor Quirrell took up the cauldron and poured out a ridiculously huge volume of effulgent liquid, more than seemed like it could fit in a dozen cauldrons, onto the purple fire that guarded the doorway. The purple fire winked out.
"Now for the mirror," said Professor Quirrell, and he drew forth the cloak of invisibility from his robes and floated it to drop before Harry's shoes.
Chapter 109. Reflections.
Even the greatest artifact can be defeated by a counter-artifact that is lesser, but specialized.
That was what the defense professor had told Harry after dropping the true cloak of invisibility to pool in fuliginous folds near Harry's shoes.
The mirror of perfect reflection has power over what is reflected within it, and that power is said to be unchallengeable. But since the true cloak of invisibility produces a perfect absence of image, it should evade this principle rather than challenging it.
There had followed a series of questions in Parseltongue, establishing that Harry currently did not intend to do anything stupid or try to run away, and further reminders that Professor Quirrell could sense him, and had spells to detect the cloak, and was holding hostage hundreds of lives, plus Hermione. Then Harry was told to don the cloak, open the door that lay beyond the quenched fires, and advance through the door into the final chamber, as Professor Quirrell stood well back, outside of that door's sight. The last chamber was illuminated in lights of soft gold, and the stone walls were of gentle white and faced with marble. In the centre of the room stood a simple and unornamented golden frame, and within the frame was a portal to another gold-illuminated room, beyond whose door which lay another potions chamber. That was what Harry's brain told him. The mirror's transformation of light was so perfect that conscious thought was required to deduce that the room inside the frame was only a reflection rather than a portal, though it might have been easier to intuit if Harry hadn't been invisible just then. The mirror did not touch the ground. The golden frame had no feet. It didn't look like it was hovering. It looked like it was fixed in place, more solid and more motionless than the walls themselves, like it was nailed to the reference frame of the earth's motion.
"Is the mirror there? Is it moving?"
came Professor Quirrell's commanding voice from the potions chamber.
"Is there?"
Harry hissed back.
"Not moving!"
Again tones of command rang forth.
"Walk around to the back of the mirror!"
From behind, the golden frame appeared solid, showing no reflections, and Harry said so in Parseltongue.
"Now take off your cloak!"
commanded Professor Quirrell's voice, still from within the potions room.
"Report to me at once if the mirror moves to face you."
Harry took off his cloak. The mirror remained nailed to its reference frame of Earth's motion, and Harry reported this. Shortly after, there came a hissing and seething, and a balefire phoenix melted through the marble wall behind Harry, the ambient light in the room taking on a red tinge as it entered. Professor Quirrell followed behind it, walking out of the new-made corridor that had been carved, his black formal robes unharmed by the red glowing molten surface beneath.
"Well," Professor Quirrell said, "that is one possible trap averted. And now..."
Professor Quirrell exhaled.
"Now we will think of possible strategies for retrieving the stone from the mirror, and you will try them. For I prefer not to let my own image be reflected. I give you fair warning. This is the part that may prove tedious."
"I take it this isn't a problem you can solve with fiend fire?"
"Ha!"
said Professor Quirrell, and gestured. The balefire phoenix moved forward in a rush of crimson terror, the red light casting writhing shadows on the remaining marble walls. Harry jumped back before he could think. The dreadful dark red blaze rushed past Professor Quirrell, surged into the golden back of the mirror, and disappeared as fast as it touched the gold. Then the fire was gone, and the room was tinged scarlet no more. There was no scratch upon the golden surface, no glow to mark the absorption of heat. The mirror had simply remained in place, untouched. Chills went down Harry's spine. If he'd been playing Dungeons and Dragons and the Dungeon Master had reported that result, Harry would have suspected a mental illusion and rolled to disbelieve. Upon the centre of the golden back had appeared a sequence of runes in no known alphabet, black absences of light in small lines and curves, arranged in a level, horizontal row. The thought occurred to Harry that some minor concealing illusion had been consumed in the fiendfire, a far lesser enchantment that had been added to prevent children from seeing those letters.
"How old is this mirror?"
Harry said in almost a whisper.
"Nobody knows, Mr. Potter."
The defense professor reached out his fingers towards the runes, a look of something like reverence on his face. But his fingers did not touch the gold.
"But my guess is the same as yours, I think. It is said, in certain legends that may or may not be fabrications, that this mirror reflects itself perfectly, and therefore its existence is absolutely stable. So stable that the mirror was able to survive when every other effect of Atlantis was undone. All its consequences severed from time. You can see why I was amused when you suggested fiend fire."
The defense professor let his hand fall. Even in the middle of everything else, Harry felt in awe, if that was true. The golden frame gleamed no brighter than before, for all the revelation. But you could imagine it going back and back into a civilization that had been made to never be.
"What does the mirror do, exactly?"
"An excellent question," said Professor Quirrell. "The answer is in the runes that are written upon the mirror's golden frame. Read them to me."
"They're not in any alphabet I recognize. They look like randomly oriented chicken scratches drawn by Tolkien elves."
"Read them anyway. Is not dangerous."
"The runes say, Neutel of the Telopatse, Tenerhokrui, Tubekafroi, Tonwasi."
Harry stopped, feeling more prickles at his spine. Harry knew what the rune for Neutel of meant. It meant Neutelov, and the next rune said to Detalo the Neutelov until it reached Patsy, then keep the part that was both Tener and Hok. That belief felt like knowledge, like he could have answered yes with confident authority if somebody asked him whether the Tonwoi was Roy or Bekafroy. It was just that when Harry tried to relate those concepts to any other concepts, he drew a blank.
"Do you understand what words mean, boy?"
"Don't think so."
Professor Quirrell gave a soft exhalation, his eyes not leaving the golden frame.
"Ah. I had wondered if perhaps the words of false comprehension might be understandable to a student of Muggle science. Apparently not."
"Maybe,"
Harry began.
"Really, Ravenclaw?"
said Slytherin.
"You're pulling this now?" "Maybe I could try again to understand the words if I knew more about the mirror,"
said Harry's Ravenclaw part, which had assumed direct control. Professor Quirrell's lips quirked up.
As with most ancient things, scholars have written down enough lies that it is hard to be sure of anything by now. It is definite that the mirror is at least as old as Merlin, for it is known that Merlin used it as a tool. It is also known that after his death, Merlin left written instructions that the mirror did not need to be sealed away, despite it having certain powers that might normally cause one to worry. He wrote that, given how painstakingly the mirror had been crafted to not destroy the world, it would be easier to destroy the world using a lump of cheese.
This statement struck Harry as not entirely reassuring.
Certain other facts about the mirror are attested by famous wizards who are reasonably skeptical, and whose word has otherwise proven reliable. The mirror's most characteristic power is to create alternate realms of existence, though these realms are only as large in size as what can be seen within the mirror. It is known that people and other objects can be stored therein. It is claimed by several authorities that the mirror alone of all magics possesses a true moral orientation, though I am not sure what that could mean in practical terms. I would expect moralists to call the Cruciatus Curse by their name of evil, and the Patronus Charm by their name of good. I cannot guess what a moralist would think was any more moral than that. But it is claimed, for example, that phoenixes came into our world from a realm that was invoked inside this mirror.
Words like jeepers and what his parents would have termed inappropriate language were all running through Harry's head, none very coherently, as he stared at the golden back of the mirror.
I have wandered the world and encountered many stories that are not often heard,
said Professor Quirrell.
Most of them seemed to me to be lies, but if you had the ring of history rather than storytelling, upon a wall of metal, in a place where no one had come for centuries, I found written the claim that some Atlanteans foresaw their world's end, and sought to forge a device of great power to avert the inevitable catastrophe. If that device had been completed, the story claimed, it would have become an absolutely stable existence that could withstand the channeling of unlimited magic in order to grant wishes. And also, this was said to be the vastly harder task, the device would somehow avert the inevitable catastrophes any sane person would expect to follow from that premise. The aspect I found interesting was that, according to the tale writ upon those metal plates, the rest of Atlantis ignored this project and went upon their ways. It was sometimes praised as a noble public endeavor, but nearly all other Atlanteans found more important things to do on any given day than help. Even the Atlantean nobles ignored the prospect of somebody other than themselves obtaining unchallengeable power, which a less experienced cynic might expect to catch their attention. With relatively little support, the tiny handful of would-be makers of this device labored under working conditions that were not so much dramatically arduous as pointlessly annoying. Eventually, time ran out, and Atlantis was destroyed, with the device still far from complete. I recognize certain echoes of my own experience that one does not usually see invented in mere tales.
A twist in the dry smile.
But perhaps that is merely my own preference for one tale among 100 other legends. You perceive, however, the echo of Merlin's statement about the mirror's creators shaping it to not destroy the world. Most importantly for our purposes, it may explain why the mirror would have the previously unknown capability that Dumbledore, or Perronel, seems to have invoked, of showing any person who steps before it an illusion of a world in which one of their desires has been fulfilled. It is the sort of sensible precaution you can imagine someone building into a wish-granting creation meant to not go horribly wrong.
Wow, Harry whispered, and meant it. This was magic, with a capital M. The sort of magic that appeared in,
"So, you want to be a wizard?"
Not just a collection of random physics-violating things you could do with a wand.
Professor Quirrell gestured at the golden back.
The final property upon which most tales agree is that whatever the unknown means of commanding the mirror, of that key, there are no plausible accounts. The mirror's instructions cannot be shaped to react to individual people, so it is not possible for Perronel to command this mirror. Only give the stone to Perronel. Dumbledore cannot state, only give the stone to one who wishes to give it to Nicholas Flamel. There is in the mirror a blindness such as philosophers have attributed to ideal justice. It must treat all who come before it by the same rule, whatever rule may be in force. Thus, there must be some rule for reaching the stone's hiding place which anyone can invoke. And now you see why you, called the boy who lived, shall implement whatever strategies the two of us devise. For it was said that this thing possesses a moral orientation, and it may have been given commands reflecting the same. I am well aware that on conventional terms you are said to be good, just as I am said to be evil.
Professor Quirrell smiled rather darkly.
So, as our first attempt, though not our last, rest assured, let us see what this mirror makes of your attempt to retrieve the stone in order to save the life of Hermione Granger and hundreds of your fellow students.
And the first version of that plan,
said Harry, who was beginning to finally understand,
the one you invented on Friday in my first week of Hogwarts called for the stone to be retrieved by Dumbledore's golden child, the boy who lived, making a selfless and noble attempt to save the life of his dying defense teacher, Professor Quirrell.
Of course, said Professor Quirrell.
It was a poetical sort of plot, Harry supposed, but his appreciation of that elegance was being hampered by the surrounding circumstances. Then another thought occurred to Harry.
Harry said, You think that this mirror is a trap for you?
There is no way beneath the heavens that it is not meant as a trap.
That is to say, it's a trap for Lord Voldemort, only it can't be a trap for him personally. There has to be a general rule that underlies it, some generalizable quality of Lord Voldemort that triggers it.
Without conscious awareness, Harry was frowning hard at the mirror's golden back.
As you say, said Professor Quirrell, who was beginning to frown at Harry's frowning.
Well, on the first Thursday of the year, the mad headmaster Dumbledore, who I'd just seen incinerate a chicken, told me that I had no chance whatsoever of getting into his forbidden corridor, since I didn't know the spell Alohomora.
I see, said Professor Quirrell. Oh, dear. I wish you had thought to mention this to me a good deal earlier.
Neither of them needed to state aloud the obvious, that this bit of reverse psychology had successfully ensured that Harry would stay the heck away from Dumbledore's forbidden corridor.
Harry was still concentrating.
Do you think Dumbledore suspects that I am, in his terms, a horcrux of Lord Voldemort, or more generally, that some aspects of my personality were copied off Lord Voldemort?
Even as Harry asked this aloud, he realized what a dumb question it was, and how much completely blatant evidence he had already seen that
Dumbledore cannot possibly have missed it, said Professor Quirrell. It is not exactly subtle. What else is Dumbledore to think? That you are an actor in a play whose stupid author has never met a real 11-year-old? Only a gibbering dullard would believe that. Never mind.
The two of them stared at the mirror in silence. Finally, Professor Quirrell sighed.
I have outwitted myself, I fear. Neither you nor I dare be reflected in this mirror. I suppose I must command Professor Sprout to undo my obliviations of Mr. Knott and Miss Greengrass. You see, the other great difficulty of the mirror is that the rule by which it treats those reflected will disregard external forces, such as false memories or a confundus charm. The mirror reflects only those forces arising from within the person themselves, the states of mind they arrive at through their own choices. So it is said in several places. That is why I had Mr. Knott and Miss Greengrass believing different stories about why the stone's extraction was necessary, ready to appear before this mirror.
Professor Quirrell rubbed at the bridge of his nose.
I constructed other stories for other students, ready for me to set into motion with the chosen trigger. But as this day approached, I began to feel pessimistic about the project. Such as Knott and Greengrass still seem worth trying if we cannot think of something better. But I wonder if Dumbledore has tried to construct this puzzle to specifically resist Voldemort's cunning. I wonder if he might have succeeded. If you devise an alternative plan which I approve enough to try, I promise this, that whatever pawn I send forth shall not be harmed by me, then or ever, nor do I expect to break that promise. And I remind you again of the hostages I hold to my failure, both Miss Granger and all the others."
Again they stared at the mirror in silence, the elder Tom Riddle and the younger.
"I suspect, Professor," Harry said after a time, "that your entire class of hypotheses about somebody needing to want the stone for good or honest purposes is mistaken. The headmaster wouldn't set a retrieval rule like that."
"Why?"
"Because Dumbledore knows how easy it is to end up believing that you're doing the right thing when you're actually not. It'd be the first possibility he imagined."
"Is it truth or trickery that I hear?"
"Am being honest,"
Harry said.
Professor Quirrell nodded. "Then your point is well taken."
"I'm not sure why you think this puzzle is solvable,"
Harry said.
"Just set a rule like your left hand must hold a small blue pyramid and two large red pyramids, and your right hand must be squeezing mayonnaise onto a hamster."
"No,"
Professor Quirrell said.
"No, I think not. The legends are unclear on what rules can be given, but I think it must have something to do with the mirror's original intended use. It must have something to do with the deep desires and wishes arising from within the person. Squeezing mayonnaise onto a hamster will not qualify as that, for most people."
"Ah,"
Harry said.
"Maybe the rule is that the person has to not want to use the stone at all. No, that's too easy. The story you gave Mr. Knott solves it."
"In some ways you may understand Dumbledore better than I,"
said Professor Quirrell.
"So now, I ask you this. How would Dumbledore use his notion of the acceptance of death to guard this stone? For that, above all, he thinks I cannot comprehend. And he is not far wrong."
Harry thought about this for a while, considering several ideas and discarding them. And then, having thought of something, Harry considered remaining silent, before mapping out the obvious part of the future conversation where Professor Quirrell asked him to say in Parseltongue if he'd thought of something. Reluctantly, Harry spoke.
"Would Dumbledore think that this mirror could reach the afterlife? Could he put the stone into something that he thinks is an afterlife, so that only people who believe in an afterlife can see it?"
Professor Quirrell said. "Possibly. Yes, there is a certain plausibility to it. Using this setting of the mirror to show people their heart's desires, Albus Dumbledore would see himself reunited with his family. He would see himself united with them in death, wanting to die himself rather than wishing for them to be returned to life. His brother Aberforth, his sister Ariana, his parents Kendra and Percival. It would be Aberforth to whom Dumbledore gave the stone, I think. Would the mirror recognize that Aberforth particularly had been given the stone? Or will any person's dead relative do, if that person believes their relative's spirit would give them back the stone?
Professor Quirrell was pacing in a short circle, keeping well away from Harry and the mirror as he moved.
But all this is only one idea. Let us devise another.
Harry began to tap his cheek, then stopped abruptly as he realized where he'd picked up that gesture.
What if Perenelle is the one who put the stone in here? Maybe she keyed the mirror to give the stone only to the person who put it in originally.
Perenelle has lived this long by knowing her limitations, said Professor Quirrell. She does not overestimate her own intellect. She is not prideful. If that were so, she would have lost the stone long ago. Perenelle would not try to think of a good mirror rule herself, not when Master Flamel can leave the matter in Dumbledore's wiser hands. But the rule of only returning the stone to the one who remembers placing it also works if Dumbledore himself has placed the stone. It would be a hard rule to bypass, since I cannot simply confound someone into believing that they put in the stone. I would have to create a false stone and a false mirror and arrange the drama.
Professor Quirrell was frowning now.
But it is still something that Dumbledore would imagine Voldemort being able to arrange, given time. If at all possible, Dumbledore will want to make the key to the mirror a state of mind he thinks I cannot arrange in a pawn, or a rule that Dumbledore thinks Voldemort can never comprehend, such as a rule involving the acceptance of one's own death. That is why I considered your previous idea plausible.
Then Harry had an idea. He was not sure if it was a good idea. It wasn't like Harry had a lot of choice here.
Arguendo, Harry said. We're not sure what's necessary to retrieve the stone, but a sufficient condition should involve Albus Dumbledore, or maybe someone else, in a state of mind where they believe that the Dark Lord has been defeated, that the threat is over, and that it is time to take out the stone and give it back to Nicholas Flamel. We aren't sure which part of that person's state of mind, let's say Dumbledore's, will be the necessary part that he thinks Lord Voldemort can't understand or duplicate. But under those conditions, Dumbledore's entire state of mind will be sufficient.
Reasonable, said Professor Quirrell. So,
the corresponding strategy, Harry said carefully, is to mimic Dumbledore's state of mind under those conditions in as much detail as possible, while standing in front of the mirror. And this state of mind must have been produced by internal forces, not external ones.
But how are we to get that without legitimacy or the Confundus charm, both of which would certainly be external? Ah, I see.
Professor Quirrell's ice-pale eyes were suddenly piercing.
You suggest that I confound myself, as you cast that hex upon yourself during your first day in battle magic, so that it is an internal force, and not an external one. A state of mind that comes about through only my own choices. Say to me whether you have made this suggestion with the intention of trapping me, boy. Say it to me in parcel tongue.
My mind that you asked to devise strategy may perhaps have been influenced by such an intent. Who knows? Knew you would be suspicious. Ask this very question. Decision is up to you, teacher. I know nothing you do not know about whether this is likely to trap you. Do not call it betrayal by me if you choose this yourself and it fails.
Harry felt a strong impulse to smile and suppressed it.
Lovely, said Professor Quirrell, who was smiling. I suppose that there are some threats from an inventive mind that even questioning in parcel tongue cannot neutralize.
Harry put on the cloak of invisibility at Professor Quirrell's orders to
stop the man who shall believe himself to be schoolmaster from seeing you,
as Professor Quirrell said in parcel tongue.
Wearing the cloak or no, you will stand in range of the mirror yourself,
Professor Quirrell said.
If a gush of lava comes forth, you will also burn. I feel that much symmetry should apply.
Professor Quirrell pointed to a spot near the right of the door through which they'd entered the room, before the mirror and well back of it. Harry, wearing the cloak, went to where Professor Quirrell had pointed him, and did not argue. It was increasingly unclear to Harry whether both Riddles dying here would be a bad thing, even with hundreds of other student hostages at stake. For all of Harry's good intentions, he'd mostly shown himself so far to be an idiot, and the returned Lord Voldemort was a threat to the entire world. Though, either way, Harry couldn't see Dumbledore doing the lava thing. Dumbledore was probably sufficiently angry at Voldemort to discard his usual restraint, but lava wouldn't permanently stop an entity that Dumbledore believed to be a discorporate soul. Then, Professor Quirrell pointed with his wand and a shimmering circle appeared around where Harry was standing on the floor. This, Professor Quirrell said, would soon become a greater circle of concealment, by which nothing within that circle could be heard or seen from the outside. Harry would not be able to make himself apparent to the false Dumbledore by taking off the cloak, nor by shouting.
You will not cross this circle once it is active, Professor Quirrell said. That would cause you to touch my magic, and while confounded, I might not remember how to halt the resonance that would destroy us both. And further, since I do not want you throwing shoes.
Professor Quirrell made another gesture, and just within the greater circle of concealment, a slight shimmer appeared in the air. A globe-shaped distortion.
This barrier will explode if touched by you or other material thing. The resonance might lash at me afterward, but you would also be dead. Now tell me in parcel tongue that you do not intend to cross this circle or take off your cloak, or do anything at all impulsive or stupid. Tell me you will wait quietly here, under the cloak, until this is over."
"This," Harry repeated back. Then Professor Quirrell's robes became black, tinged with gold, such robes as Dumbledore might wear upon a formal occasion, and Professor Quirrell pointed his own wand at his head. Professor Quirrell stayed motionless for a long time, still holding his wand to his head. His eyes were closed in concentration. And then Professor Quirrell said,
"Confound us."
At once, the expression of the man standing there changed. He blinked a few times as though confused, lowering his wand. A deep weariness spread over the face Professor Quirrell had worn. Without any visible change, his eyes seemed older, the few lines in his face calling attention to themselves. His lips were set in a sad smile. Without any hurry, the man quietly walked over to the mirror, as though he had all the time in the world. He crossed into the mirror's range of reflection, without anything happening, and stared into the surface. What the man might be seeing there, Harry could not tell. To Harry, it seemed that the flat, perfect surface still reflected the room behind it, like a portal to another place.
"Ariana," breathed the man. "Mother, father, and you, my brother, it is done."
The man stood still, as if listening.
"Yes, done," the man said. "Voldemort came before this mirror, and was trapped by Merlin's method. He is only one more sealed horror now."
Again, the listening stillness.
"I would that I could obey you, my brother, but it is better this way."
The man bowed his head.
"He is denied his death forever. That vengeance is terrible enough."
Harry felt a twinge watching this, a sense that this was not what Dumbledore would have said. It seemed more like a straw man, a shallow stereotype. But then this wasn't the real Aberforth spirit either. This was who Professor Quirrell imagined Dumbledore imagined Aberforth was, and that doubly reflected image of Aberforth wouldn't notice anything amiss.
"It is time to give back the Philosopher's Stone," said the man who thought he was Dumbledore. "It must go back into Master Flamel's keeping now."
Listening stillness.
"No," said the man. "Master Flamel has kept it safe these many years from all who would seek immortality, and I think it will be safest in his hands. No, Aberforth, I do think his intentions are good."
Harry couldn't control the tension that was running through him like a live wire. He was having trouble breathing. Imperfect. Professor Quirrell's Confundus charm had been imperfect. The underlying personality of Professor Quirrell was leaking through and seeing the obvious question. Why it was okay for Nicholas Flamel himself to have the stone if immortality was so awful? Even if Professor Quirrell conceptualized Dumbledore as being blind to the question, Professor Quirrell hadn't included a clause in the Confundus saying that Dumbledore's image of Aberforth wouldn't think of it. And all of this was ultimately a reflection of Professor Quirrell's own mind, an image from within the intelligence of Tom Riddle.
"Destroy it," said the man. "Maybe. I am not sure it can be destroyed, or Master Flamel would have done it long since. I think many times that he has regretted making it. Aberforth, I promised him, and we are not so ancient or so wise ourselves. The Philosopher's Stone must go back into the keeping of the one who made it."
And Harry's breath stopped. The man was holding an irregular chunk of scarlet glass in his left hand, the size, perhaps, of Harry's thumb from fingernail to the first joint. The sheened surface of the scarlet glass made it seem wet. The appearance was of blood, suspended in time and made into a jagged surface.
"Thank you, my brother," the man said quietly.
"Is that what the stone should look like? Does Professor Quirrell know what the true stone should look like? Will the mirror give back the real stone under these conditions, or make an imitation and return that?"
And then...
"No, Ariana," the man said, smiling gently. "I fear I must go now. Be patient, my dearest. It will be soon enough that I join you in truth. Why, I am not sure why I must go. When I hold the stone, I am to step aside from the mirror and wait for Master Flamel to contact me. But I am not sure why I need to step aside from the mirror to do that."
The man sighed. "Ah.